Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. I asked you earlier today to tell us a story about a time you've lost a loved one. What have people said to you or done for you that has helped you or made you feel worse? And we have some people here later in the show who specialize in what it's like to grieve and to help somebody who's grieving. I hope you can stay tuned. I'm glad you're listening today. Happy May Day to you. May Day, yes, in Seattle, that means demonstrations. Marches, protests, peaceful protests, hopefully, and an even worse than usual evening commute. So reporter Paige Browning is here from the KUOW newsroom. Hiya, Paige.
Hey, Bill.
Who is demonstrating? Who's protesting? Where? When? What do we know?
Sure. Well, the main event this year is the May Day March for Immigrant and Workers' Rights. It's in its 19th year. It happens every year in Seattle. And this is going to be the big one. Could attract hundreds or thousands of people. It's led by the May 1st Action Coalition and El Comité, and it's backed by dozens of other groups, so they'll all be there. And this march is about workers' rights, and specifically this year, it's about topics that affect immigrants. The marchers are calling for an end to deportations. So this is the event that's permitted by the city. Mm-hmm. It'll meet at 2:30 at Judkins Park. That's in the Central District. And then they'll march downtown on South Jackson Street, and they'll end up at 2nd Avenue and Spring just in time for rush hour.
All right. And some other events are planned as well today.
Yeah, there are several other things happening, including there's a block party with music and speeches led by the group Block the Juvie. This is the group that has blocked construction at the new Juvenile Justice Center recently.
Mm-hmm.
The right-wing groups Patriot Prayer and Proud Boys, they're planning to rally at Westlake Park. They say they're gathering specifically to protest against anti-fascists. And there are some other protests and May Day celebration events, including a May Day Maypole celebration at Fremont in the Fremont neighborhood, too.
Yes. And the question hanging over every May Day is how raucous, how destructive, how violent could this get?
Yeah. Basically, officials say if you live downtown, if you own a business downtown, bring in your outside furniture, bring in your signs. Things could be destroyed. Things could be used as a weapon if any of the activities turn violent. If you have a dumpster, lock it. In the past, protests have turned violent with opposing groups fighting and some property damage, and police are going to be watching for that.
Although there was the peace joint last year.
There was a peace joint. Right-wing and left-wing groups shared a Pepsi and a joint. We'll see what happens this year.
What about the Seattle Police Department? What do they say they plan today?
Well, of course, they say officers, they're going to follow the marches and protests. They have made arrests in the past, 5 last year for weapon possession, for obstruction, assault. They've arrested people actually for the past several years when some small riots broke out in the march. And there have been this year some posters and some comments online saying that certain buildings like the Amazon Spheres could be targeted for protests.
Oh, those are new. I hadn't thought about
They're brand new.
And glassy.
And glass. Yeah. And police, you know, they wouldn't comment specifically about the Spheres, but they said, look, we're going to be following where the crowds are. If anything happens, we're going to be ready. And they will be armed with firearms and with blast balls. These hurt, and they're actually thrown by hand, but they hurt. They're meant to disperse groups, and police say they will use them if necessary. And they're also getting some help from outside law enforcement, including the State Patrol this year.
So, Paige, if I'm just trying to get home at rush hour, I should do what?
Well, if you have to be downtown or take the freeway, you're going to be stuck in traffic. If you can avoid that, take another route. That's what I would say. King County Metro says some buses, they could be delayed or canceled. Please be patient. That's their message. They're just asking that people understand and plan for delays. And there's another snag. 15,000 people are going to be headed to Soto tonight because the Mariners are playing. They're home. They'll be first pitch 7:10, so a lot of people on the roads and light rail. Basically, transit officials just say, be patient. They don't really have another option. And they will be closing the streets downtown during the march, during rolling closures. Once the march passes a street, they'll reopen it. But downtown's just going to be jammed.
Okay. You might want to take 520 East, head out that way, come down, cross the Cascades, down to the Columbia River and come up around that way.
Exactly. Or walk.
Or walk. Paige Browning from KUOW's newsroom, thanks a lot for that.
Thanks, Bill.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW Seattle, and you're about to meet one of the members of Congress from Washington State in just a moment. Stay tuned. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you're listening. I'm joined now in the studio by Congressmember Susan DelBene, who represents the 1st District of Washington. So that's parts of King, Snohomish, Whatcom, Skagit counties up to the north. Welcome.
From here all the way up to the Canadian border.
To the border. Yep. Thanks for coming in on this May Day.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So here we were just talking about this, all these demonstrations for immigrant and workers' rights. Are you going to be on the street today, anywhere near them? What are your plans?
I won't be downtown, but this is an important conversation. Immigration reform, since I've been a member of Congress since 2012, we've been talking about the importance of immigration reform. It's incredibly disappointing that Congress hasn't acted yet. We need comprehensive immigration reform. We agree on both sides of the aisle that we have a broken immigration system, but there has been many bipartisan efforts, and it's disappointing that we've never been allowed a vote on immigration legislation, let alone passing legislation to protect Dreamers, something that's very bipartisan.
Yes.
Put it on the floor and let us vote. And I actually think we'd pass legislation that would make a big difference.
Well, there is a bipartisan proposal in the House to bring 4 separate immigration bills to a vote, Republican and Democrat, different proposals, and the one that gets the most votes would advance to the Senate. Will you vote for that idea?
So it's called the Queen of the Hill.
Yes.
And the 4 bills would come to the floor, and the one that gets the most votes then comes back to the floor to be voted on. And so definitely I think that anything that gets bills to the floor really will be good progress, because it requires members of Congress to actually vote and be accountable and talk to people what they agree with or disagree with. And we have bipartisan pieces of legislation that I'm 2 of those bills that I think would make a huge difference and that we could get a lot of support for.
But what if the one that gets the most votes, what if the Queen of the Hill is, say, a Republican bill that only gives temporary 3-year status to DACA recipients, reduces annual immigration by 40%, eliminates the ability of citizens to sponsor family members, parents, adult kids, brothers, sisters? Would that be a good outcome if that's the queen of the hill for you?
Then I'm going to vote no on that. And many of my colleagues will vote no. In the end,
but would you not prefer the gridlock that you described to that outcome?
I think that we haven't seen the opportunities for bipartisanship to move forward because bills are always prevented from coming to the floor.
There's
bipartisanship. There's a bill that Congressman Aguilar and Congressman Hurd put together that I'm on. It is bipartisan. They've had bipartisan support and been bringing people together on both sides. Those are bills like that that I think have broad support that could move forward. But we're not going to know if we don't give folks the opportunity to vote. And I think that we could make a big difference that way. If there's a really bad bill, I think that we're going to see folks vote against it. And they could move those bills forward today without the Queen of the Hill if they wanted to. They could only move a really bad bill forward. This way, all the bills get to be considered.
Here's President Trump talking yesterday about weak and deadly immigration laws.
I have called on Congress to close deadly immigration loopholes that are exploited by terrorists, traffickers, and criminals. Just look at our southern border and our weak and obsolete immigration laws. They are obsolete, and they are weak, and they are pathetic. And there's no country in the world that has laws like we do.
So he's calling on Congress to close deadly immigration loopholes. What loopholes is he talking about?
I think it's always hard to know when he uses so much rhetoric what specifically he means. We need to pass comprehensive immigration reform, and Congress needs to act. This is something we've needed to do for a long time, and the more we wait, the more urgent the issue becomes. When I first became a member of Congress, I helped introduce a bipartisan comprehensive immigration reform bill. I think it would have passed if we had just been allowed a vote.
It would have done what?
It would have addressed all of our issues. It would have addressed Dreamers. It would have addressed border security. It would have addressed
legal status for Dreamers?
Seasonal workers, legal status, okay. and citizen path to citizenship. It addressed all those things. It was a bipartisan bill. The Senate had passed similar piece of legislation in the Senate. We never were allowed to vote.
Would you vote for President Trump's border wall if you could trade that for permanent legal status for people who were brought here as kids?
I think we need to do responsible immigration reform, comprehensive immigration reform.
Or would you make that trade?
But I don't know what that trade is because I don't know specifically what you're talking about. But I would.
Well, you know, some Democrats have said that they refuse to fund a border wall in any way. But the president has said, it goes back and forth, but has said, you say you want permanent legal status for these so-called dreamers. This is how you can do it.
And the president has never been specific on what he would really do. He talked about this with respect to dreamers and deferred action for childhood arrivals or DACA. And that never turned into anything on his side either. So I think this kind of constant attempt to really politicize and be demeaning when he talks about immigration reform isn't what's going to help us move forward. We need Congress to sit down and put together responsible legislation.
Okay.
And we need to pass in the House and the Senate. And then the president will have to make a decision on whether he signs that or not.
Again, this is Congressmember Susan DelBene, who represents Western and Northwestern Washington State, a Democrat in Congress. And here's what some people think of Congress. I've heard this for my whole life. This is happens to be comedian Michelle Wolf at the White House Correspondents' Dinner over the weekend.
And just a reminder to everyone, I'm here to make jokes. I have no agenda. I'm not trying to get anything accomplished. So everyone that's here from Congress, you should feel right at home.
I think Will Rogers used to make that joke about 80 years ago. First of all, funny?
Well, I think, unfortunately, it's true that things have not been getting done. And when you're talking about immigration reform, just letting the legislative process work, letting us have a debate on bills in committees, letting committees make decisions and moving legislation forward, having hearings. We had a big tax bill. We didn't have a hearing on that tax bill beforehand. We got a bill just right before we went in to mark it up in committee, and we got a bill that we hadn't had its chance to see. Frankly, a lot of Republicans hadn't had a chance to see, and it was jammed through the House. It's a terrible way.
So maybe Congress should do less because they should be more deliberative.
I think we should actually sit down and talk about issues, understand the impacts, bring experts in, bring people from different parts of our community to talk about the impacts a particular piece of legislation would have on them. And let us consider this and debate and have a healthy debate, sometimes agree to disagree, and move it forward. And in the end, let members vote. Because votes make us accountable for the decisions we make. We explain to folks why we might have voted yes or voted no. But by doing nothing, we don't solve any problems. And we leave many things unanswered and folks able to say they support and don't support something at the same time.
Oh, yes. Now, you're a Democrat. This is what that comedian Michelle Wolf said about your party.
But I also want to make fun of Democrats. Democrats are harder to make fun of because you guys don't do anything. People think you might flip the House and Senate this November, but you guys always find a way to mess it up. You're somehow going to lose by 12 points to a guy named Jeff Pedophile Nazi Doctor. Oh, he's a doctor.
Democrats are losers. Is that fair?
I think that we are doing incredible work listening to people across our country, really talking about the important issues that we should be talking about, things like immigration reform, like economic opportunity for people across our country, about an economy going forward. What are the jobs of the future? How do we make sure we're prepared for the future? How do we make sure that our children are getting the education they need, that we provide workforce training, that we build an economy on clean, renewable energy and understand the changes that are happening in our climate? Actually looking at data and facts and science, it's incredibly important that we move forward on these issues. And these are things that I'm very passionate about. And I know many of my colleagues are passionate about. We need to make that case to people in our districts and across the country. And we also have to make sure that people have the opportunity to vote. We've had, districts that have been drawn to be very partisan across our country. We need to make sure that people's voices are heard and they get out and vote. And that will make a difference, I think, in Congress and definitely make a difference this coming election cycle.
Well, here's an example of what Democrats themselves are debating internally. I promise this is the final comedian, a case of a comedian. This is Bill Maher on his HBO show, also criticizing Democrats as being this time too timid.
Just like the Democrats' position on coal. Love it. Had some for breakfast. And guns. I love the Second Amendment, too. They're afraid to make the counter argument. Republicans, they're all claws and sharp teeth and fangs when they fight. The Democrats, their weapon of choice is adaptive coloration.
He tells that joke because it gets a laugh, that somebody recognizes some truth in that. You are part of Congressmember Del Bene, part of the House new, quote, New Democrat Coalition.
Yes.
Is just even calling it that an attempt to address this issue that the Democratic brand is weak right now?
No, and the New Democratic Coalition has been around a little while, so
yes.
But it's really about...
What's new about it?
We want to make sure that we're talking about where we're headed, about economic opportunity, about the willing to sit down and work with others and actually get things done. I represent a swing district. Our redistricting commission said it was designed to be the most evenly divided district in the country.
Yes.
So every political point of view possible is represented in my district. I get to hear feedback, which is, I actually think our politics across the country would be a lot better if we had a few more districts like mine.
Yes, up to the Canadian border, as we said.
Up to the Canadian border, a lot of agriculture,
yep.
Technology, and yet... I have an incredible opportunity to hear feedback and connect with people and hear different points of view and have to balance those and weigh those when I make a decision on a piece of legislation.
Well, mostly I associate the New Democrat Coalition with pro-trade. I think of it as a relatively centrist type of organization compared to the Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker, Kirsten Gillibrand wing, who just, for example, proposed an FDR-style program of guaranteed jobs for all. We've heard about government-paid health care for all. Democrats, go bold. Where are you on those two issues?
Let's try things. I'm a big believer in pilots. I think that we should see what's working and what's not working and adapt. So let's look at where the future is taking us. I'm introduced legislation on portable benefits. We want to make sure that people have access to benefits, whatever type of work they're doing. And we've talked about the gig economy and the changes that are happening there. So let's try some things. Let's have programs where we have pilots where people try and we can see what works, what doesn't work, or what circumstances influence outcomes.
Single-payer health care?
And use that to understand, to inform, and use that to inform federal policy. We've talked about, could you let people buy into Medicare, for example, as ways to allow people, a public option, make sure that people have that opportunity. Those are things that we would learn a lot from and help inform where we might go in the future.
So maybe not getting rid of private insurance, but having Medicare for more or
right.
All
people would have
more
of an option. Yeah, I think having a public option gives people that opportunity to make a decision about what they think is best for them. And if it's very successful, more and more people will make that choice. But we need to learn and try. We have a lot of dialogue. But when I talk about hearings and debates and moving and actually moving legislation, part of it also is learning and trying and being able to be innovative from a policy standpoint, because we're still catching up to yesterday in policy. We're not looking forward. And I think that's a missed opportunity.
Another example, speaking of Senator Gillibrand, Booker, Sanders, Elizabeth Warren as well, and California Senator Kamala Harris announced this week all of them are rejecting corporate PAC money. Will you follow their lead on that? And I, Susan Del Bene, will not take any corporate money, PAC money.
PAC dollars right now that people take are political actions committee. These are employees. These are individuals. It's not dollars from companies. It's dollars from people who work at organizations who collectively labor, and others have political actions committees and give to candidates too. So,
well, there's an Amazon PAC that you take $2,500 from. Do you feel any conflict about that?
Those are people. Those are people. They were set up. These are not companies it's not corporate dollars, it's employees, et cetera. But, I'm open and very supportive of campaign finance reform because we should have that. I think Citizens United moved us in the wrong direction. I think that disclosure is important. I sponsored legislation to overturn Citizens United, the Disclose Act, to make sure that we do a really good job of make sure there's transparency so you know where those dollars are coming from. In those ads that you see, they're always from some organization like Americans for Good Things.
Yes.
But you don't know who's behind it. So let's make sure that's clear, because that will make a huge difference in people understanding where the information's coming from and kind of the point of view that they're bringing to the table. But we need reform. We absolutely need campaign finance reform.
Again, this is a member of Congress, Susan DelBene, a Democrat from the 1st District. You were at Microsoft for a dozen years in a senior leadership level. Some former employees are complaining about gender discrimination, sexual harassment, a culture of casual sexism, and a male-dominated hierarchy. What was your experience at Microsoft?
Well, I think traditionally the technology industry definitely started out as very male-dominated. And it was a harsh culture. It was, whoever was loudest kind of won the conversation.
Was it sexist?
I think definitely there were not as many women, and it was a difficult culture and environment for women. So there was a lot of work to be done, and still is. We've heard about this not from any one company. We've heard about it across the board, and frankly, I think it's true a lot across many different sectors of our economy. That's why we have the ongoing conversation about equality, about making sure that everyone's voices are heard, that people have a chance to speak out when they've been mistreated.
Well, I'm curious, what do you think people don't know about what it's like to be a woman and an executive at a tech company?
I think that my experience is a while ago now.
Yes.
Understanding that.
But you represent Redmond too, right? I imagine.
I do.
Yeah,
I do.
You talked to Microsoft.
I represent Redmond up to the Canadian border, yeah. But there. My personal experience is a while ago,
yes.
But nonetheless, women, when you're in a meeting and you say something and then 5 minutes later someone else says the same thing, but people only hear it when a man says it, when there aren't necessarily equal opportunities for women to move forward into management positions, whether it is someone doing that directly or indirectly, those are places where women have faced discrimination in the workplace. Equal pay for equal work, we're still fighting for that. Women still make less than men across the board, across the board in our economy. And so these are ongoing efforts. Congress, 20% of Congress is women today.
Mm-hmm.
We should have more. And in fact, I think we have more women candidates running across the country than ever. And so we may see many more women in Congress after this next election. And that would be a great change and help make a difference.
We'll see. We're all interested in what happens this next election. Congresswoman Susan DelBene represents Redmond, and she represents Mount Vernon, among many of the cities in the 1st District. Thanks for coming into the studio and talking with us.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
It's The Record on KUOW Seattle. Back in just a moment. In the next couple of years, the Alaskan Way Viaduct will be torn down and the Seattle waterfront will open up in a new way. Gone will be the elevated highway that separates Pike Place Market from the Ferris Wheel and the Aquarium. In its place, a new large waterfront park. And who ought to pay for that park? Property owners who live around it, or all the people who will be benefiting from the new public space? It's a question KUOW's Region of Boom reporter Carolyn Adolph has been asking. Welcome, Carolyn.
Hey.
How is the city planning to pay for the new waterfront park?
Well, they have to somehow stomach $688 million. That's the slice that's for this park. And it's being paid through. I mean, they want to find $100 million worth of philanthropy. They're going to get some money from the state. But there's a $200 million wedge of that $688 million. That is labeled the Waterfront LID, the Local Improvement District, a special tax for property owners.
Yes, this is not a lid over anything. This is a local improvement district, the waterfront lid.
Right.
Which means people who live nearby or do business nearby would be paying some of that some of that money.
Oh, yeah. And the lion's share of it is definitely going to fall on the commercial landowners. You know, the Sheraton Hotel seems to be on the hook for $4 million. Amazon's a bit less than $1 million. So, you know, parking lots are going to pay. Everything. The ferry terminal is going to pay. But so will people who have been living downtown for a year or since forever.
Okay, that's the proposal anyway. And we have in the studio two people who live in this local improvement district. So they live in that in the downtown area. I would have to pay this property tax. Karen Gillen is a former Boeing employee, retired. She moved with her husband from their home in Queen Anne to downtown Seattle. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Also, former Seattle Mayor Charlie Royer, he co-chaired the committee that designed and figured out funding for the waterfront park, and he lives in that area too. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. So first of all, Karen, the Seattle waterfront tax would cost you $22,000. You live near the shiny new waterfront. How is that unfair to you?
Well, for one thing, where I live, there's very little difference between the before and after of the lid itself. Because
how do you mean?
Well, there's going to be a multi-lane highway. There's going to be the existing new sidewalks that have the glass blocks to let light in for the salmon. And the street has to be repaired to the normal standards of a Seattle street. So there'll be street vegetation and trees, et cetera. The city cannot provide a picture of what the street is going to look like after the viaduct comes down and if we never had the LID, because it doesn't seem to be that there's any difference. So
Are you saying you don't believe or you're not so sure your property value is going to go up because of the waterfront?
Actually, that's a whole other issue. But that's a possibility. I don't look at the viaduct. I don't live right next to it. So it's hard.
You don't have a waterfront facing condo.
No.
Okay.
So okay, you're not going to get a killer view, and you're saying that you don't really think that the waterfront park is going to really change the look of what you're going to see on the street side?
Not in my particular place.
Oh.
But if you look at the website from the city, everything says that this is a regional asset. This is a gateway to Seattle. This is for everybody that visits or lives in Seattle. And interestingly enough, in 2014, we all, property owners and others, passed a new park district to cover recreation, including maintaining parklands and facilities, operating community centers, recreation programs, and developing new neighborhood parks on previously acquired sites. It doesn't say except downtown Seattle.
Mm. Okay.
So we're paying for all of the new parks and refurbished parks and upgrade parks in the city, but we're asked to pay for the one that might be right next to us.
Former Seattle Mayor Charlie Royer, you will be paying $19,000, and you think this is fair that people who live in the downtown area should pay this one-time property tax. Why? What do you say to her objections?
Well, first of all, I think you have to recognize that this is a big project that is paid for by a lot of taxpayers. It's almost a $5 billion project that is being paid for by the state, the federal government, the port. I mean, every government is stepping up. And the biggest cost of this thing is the transportation piece, a $3 billion tunnel and road paid for by the state and the federal government. So without that transportation investment made by people who buy gas, people who pay taxes throughout the state, we would not be building the park.
Okay, but what has that got to do with whether you should be taxed?
Well, the decision that the committee made that was appointed by a mayor from long ago, Greg Nichols, I was asked to chair the committee, and I said, I need somebody who can raise a bunch of money to help me. And so Maggie Walker became the co-chair later, and we established a citizens committee. One of the things we were asked to do is to find a designer for the park. We did that. Our park. You don't want the cities or the state of Washington DOT designing your streets or your parks in an urban area. You want a good designer doing that. This is not a wheat field in eastern Washington where you put a highway through it.
But how do you know her property values are going to go up and that she ought to pay for that?
So I was going to say that I am happy to pay a very small assessment. I'm paying something like $70, $80 a month. She's paying about $90. We both live in fairly decent condos, which we can afford to pay. It's a very small part.
Okay.
It's like 0.25% of the increased value that occurs only because of the big investment that's happening.
There you go.
Right.
So, Karen, the idea is you want to get this benefit later and not have to pay for it now.
Well, actually, you know as well as I do that property values rise and fall based on the amount available for people wanting to invest. And our current housing market in the city has driven prices up. Since I moved downtown Seattle 5 years ago, my property taxes have gone up 75%. Now, I'm retired. I don't have any additional source of new income to pay for this. So I'm forced with every time things grow, whether it be property taxes or an assessment like this, I have to consider, can I afford to stay in my home through my retirement? When I moved downtown, I didn't move up to a fancier place. I sold a large home and bought a smaller home with the idea that I would expect some growth in my costs.
Charlie Royer, she can't pass on the charge to the tourists.
It's a small, almost $2 million condo looking out over the water. So retiree's home, if you might.
But she's saying she and others who are on fixed incomes keep seeing their taxes rise and can't
take a look at the opposition to this. First of all, it surfaced early among the condo owners. From the time I started working on this project, I kept hearing over and over from people, this is only going to benefit the tourists, which is a big job producer in our city and region, and it's only going to benefit the rich condo owners. So it became not only important as part of the fairness of this funding, this huge transformational investment in our city, but it became important to spread the cost among those who benefit most, really do benefit. And those are the condo owners. I mean, my condo is went up, $300,000 just in anticipation of the waterfront. Businesses along the waterfront are selling these old buildings in Pioneer Square that are warehouse kind of buildings. They're selling for $8, $12, $15 million now.
And Karen, you can finance it. You don't have to pay it all at once.
Well, one of the issues, the $22,000 I talked about, that's the 100% of my special benefit, not the half the city says that it will take. Because if they cannot raise the other monies that they've asked for, or if a project overruns, they have the right for 10 years to take 100% of the special benefit. And they don't have the ability to commit a future city council not to take it if they need it. So that's where I differ. I do not have the kind of house that Mayor Royer spoke about. But, one of the things I need to really bring to people's attention is that not everybody who lives downtown is wealthy. A lot of people are renting. There's new apartments going in. Some of those may be rent-enabled or something. But most of them that are market rate are going to be affected eventually by this. I've been speaking to a lot of businesses down on the street, and they're basically already encumbered by raising rents. They're barely making it. They're
businesses
struggling.
Businesses pass the taxes on, as we all know, to the people who buy their goods.
And these businesses are not
tourists.
Just supporting. No, see, that's part of the problem. It is not just tourists.
You're telling me that in Pioneer Square, all those retail stores don't benefit from
tourism? Well, I tell you, in my neighborhood, we have a lot of stores that do not benefit.
In your neighborhood, you've got big furniture stores that sell.
Right. And there's lots of stores all through the area that we're talking about. And they are going to be leaving that area. What started out as a neighborhood where people could afford to buy a home and live is going to turn into a tourist playground. Is that what we really want for the center of our city? Is only people that can, and foreign investors that can afford to buy the condos that are priced out of existence? And
those are two different things. Yeah. So not tourists, but you're saying that the only people living in downtown Seattle will be foreign investors?
I'm saying
virtually?
That if we keep pricing normal people out of the neighborhood.
Well, I don't know if you remember this city when I moved here back in 1970.
Actually, I've lived here longer than that. But.
And then you maybe remember 1970. Mm-hmm. Nobody lived downtown. Mm-hmm. Downtown was a desert at night. We had a decent retail core, one of the few big cities that did, and we did everything we could to protect that. One of the things you have to do is build a neighborhood downtown, 24/7, white picket fence neighborhoods where people take care of the street and it's safe and well-lit and all that stuff. That's what we are now. We have density downtown. People are struggling to live downtown, but they can't afford it. So you're right. We have loaded up property tax. The state has done that, put the whole school burden almost on the King County and City of Seattle. So and our city council never met a tax it didn't like,
right,
ever. And so now they want $75 million to try to spend on the homeless without a plan to spend it on wisely. So I can understand people who say these taxes are out of line, but I do not understand. Look at the opposition to this LID. The big guys are going to pay the bulk of it. There is no opposition coming from the Downtown Seattle Association, the Seattle Chamber, the big property owners, the big hotels. So it's only a few condo owners, yeah, particularly living on the waterfront.
Yeah.
Who think? And if you look at the polling the Friends of Waterfront Seattle have done over the past few months, 70-80% love this waterfront, and they want to see it happen, and they believe it's a waterfront for all, and all should help pay for it.
Okay. Karen, what do you think gets lost if people of ordinary means end up being taxed out of downtown?
Well, I know that there are a lot of retirees maybe bought their condo 25 years ago and helped make downtown Seattle a vibrant community that people want to come and visit. It's almost like it's the nail in the coffin of their being able to continue living downtown. These are people that might have a studio or a one-bedroom condo that they bought at rates that you wouldn't even imagine you could buy a condo for. And so if we price those people out, we change the demographic of the area. If only very, very rich people or people that have high-paying jobs can stay, what about the couple who wrote a letter to the city council saying basically they're a dual income family. They have a little boy. They bought their condo in Pioneer Square years ago.
There were no condos in Pioneer Square years ago. It was all subsidized housing.
How many years ago? Their years ago would be
25,
maybe
30 years
okay,
ago.
Yeah, didn't they call the condo buyers the gentrifiers?
We're not talking about 25. Maybe it was 8
years
ago.
Well, you said 25 years
ago. No, I said years ago.
Okay, we're going to put a pause on this because we've got another fantastic segment coming up. But this is to give you a flavor of the fact that the city is considering this this property tax one time, or can be financed, this local improvement district to pay for what the city says is going to be a property value boon. And Carolyn, what happens next?
Well, this is certainly not set in stone. The city's taking up the issue tomorrow, and eventually they'll come to a vote on whether or not to impose this local improvement district and what kind of changes they might want to make. So without the lid or with an altered lid, then we get into a whole bunch of questions of, well, where does the money come from, and does this alter the waterfront project in any way?
Karen Gillan, Charlie Royer, thank you both. Let's do this again. We'll be following the progress of this idea. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Thanks.
It's The Record on KUOW. When you have lost a loved one, what have people said to you or done for you that's helped or has been very, very unhelpful? We want to do better. Stay tuned. This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Everything happens for a reason. Heaven needed another angel. If you've lost a loved one and you're grieving, you've probably heard a well-meaning person say something like that, supposedly comforting. Maybe you just felt uncomfortable. Maybe you felt more isolated. My next guests had similar experiences and decided to do something about it. Gabby Berkner and Rebecca Sofer are co-authors of a book called Modern Loss, Candid Conversations About Grief. Gabby and Rebecca, welcome to you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Would you mind giving us an experience that drove each of you to write this book?
Sure. This is Rebecca. When I was 30 years old, I was working for the Colbert Report daily television show, living in New York City, single, dreaming about building up a life of, you know, all the things that one might want in life, maybe a partner and a dog and a kid or two and a mortgage. And my mom was killed very suddenly in a car accident when I was 30 years old. I'm an only child between both my mom and my dad. And so it was incredibly isolating in the biggest nutshell of all to describe it. Mm. 4 years later, my dad died. So by the time I was 34, I was a literal orphan and got a crash course in how uncomfortable we are as a society talking about grief for some reason that I don't understand.
Yes, we are. Gabby, would you mind?
Sure. My story is when I was 24 and I was a newspaper reporter. My beat was obituaries because you can't really make this stuff up. I got the news that my father and stepmother had been murdered in a robbery in their home in Sedona, Arizona. And all of a sudden, again, 24 years old, it was like, Dad was murdered. Welcome to adulthood. And most of my friends hadn't lost parents by that age, and let alone known anyone who had been murdered. So like Rebecca said, it's an extraordinarily isolating experience. And even though people want to be there for you, they don't know how, and they can't possibly know how.
So you just both told me terrible things. Mm-hmm. I did not say I'm sorry for your loss.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Is that a good thing? I don't know.
No,
I mean, of course I'm kind of sorry. I just met you, but we're all sorry for other people's losses.
Look, everyone has their thing in life. Everyone has a lot of things in life that are their burdens. And I frequently say I'm so sorry when I hear about somebody who died. Of course you're sorry, but beyond that, what are you going to do, right?
Yeah, right.
It's only, I'm so sorry only does so much. What more meaningful action can you take as a friend, as a coworker, as a daughter or a parent to really help a person that you care about or even remotely like feel like they have a friend who's willing to get into an uncomfortable space with them? And that uncomfortable space is just talking about what loss is really like. And what it's really like is something that is not tied up into a neat bow that lasts 30 days or 365 days.
But how do I know what you want in that grieving time? Yeah, well, let's start there. How am I supposed to know? I'm a coworker or a friend?
Sure. I always say it's like an unfortunate reality of grief is that unfortunately the onus is often on the person who's grieving, and it shouldn't necessarily be that way. But I felt that once I told people what I needed in the aftermath of my loss, I got my needs met. So I always tell people who are going through grief or have just lost someone they love or someone they had a complicated relationship with to tell people what they need in any given moment, because there's not one set phrase or one thing to do that's going to make every person who's bereaved feel comforted in any given moment. There are certain things to say that are better than others, but there's not one set thing to say.
So what would you say? What did you say you wanted?
I mean, it depended on the day. It depended on the hour. It depended on that moment. Like, I always give this example of I once asked my friend Lindsay to come over with a stack of Celebrity Weeklies and time me on the crossword puzzles. But, like, she wouldn't have intuited that that's what I needed in the aftermath of my loss. Like, I somehow, at some point, I guess, just needed to get my mind off things. And that's what I needed.
Okay. That's very
specific and
clear.
Idiosyncratic
but
and weird. Yeah.
Specificity is our friend when it comes to experiences that are so overwhelming and surreal and unknown, unfamiliar as loss. I mean, loss is like the person who's dealing with loss is in an unfamiliar territory, and everybody around them is in an unfamiliar territory. Mm. So as long as you acknowledge that this is just like one big kind of mess that you're in together, and the person who's going through it may not know what they need in any given moment, and you may not know what to do for them, all you can do is ask and tell them that you're there. And if you really know them well, we always say, if you know the person well, you know the little things they need. You know that, like, their bathroom is going to be a disaster because they haven't cleaned it in a while.
Right.
Or their kid just needs to have a play date and get out of their hair. Or maybe they just need, like, a double martini, you know, on the rocks at, you know, every hour on the hour for, you know, a normal number of hours before it's too dangerous. It's just, like, not that hard to do that for a person, but it does require one little moment of empathic thinking.
We are talking with the authors of the new book, Modern Loss, Candid Conversations About Grief. We are live tweeting the show right now at KUOW, and we asked listeners, what has helped you in your grief and what has not helped you? So here's one of those answers.
Hi, my name is Lindsay, and I'm calling from Seattle. Actually, Vashon. I lost both my parents, and when my mom passed away, somebody said something very helpful, which was, it'll probably get worse before it gets better. And that just kind of freed me up to not think of it as anything that I had to move through or get over, and just to let it be what it would be. And then the thing that people have said was about both my parents, when they hear that they passed away, they're like, oh, they passed away? What happened? And that's just, I feel like very insensitive. And I think, you know, it's something that if you don't automatically know, then you probably don't need to know, or you need to let it come out in a different way, or you just need to ask in a different way. But that seems to be people's knee-jerk reaction thing to ask. But thank you. Bye.
Okay. So first, if someone tells me they just lost a loved one, I might say, what happened? Mm-hmm. Don't do that.
I don't know. I don't know that you shouldn't do that, to be honest. I don't necessarily think that's a wrong thing to do. I think that Lindsay probably had somebody say it to her in a tone that might have hit her the wrong way. I don't know what the relationship was. There's endless kind of permutations and combinations to human interactions.
As if I'm being voyeuristic instead of concerned about
exactly.
Lindsay.
Right.
And it's perfectly acceptable for her to say, you know what, I really don't feel like talking about it. To say, I don't think it's wrong for you to ask, but I don't think it's wrong for her to say, yeah, I'm just not comfortable with this conversation right now.
That's interesting. You have twice put some kind of, I don't know if responsibility is the word, but you're asking of something of the bereaved person.
Yeah.
You said, ask for what you want, and you said, you know, you say, I don't feel like getting into that right now.
In a perfect world, you know, the world would take care of us. They'd put the bereaved on like a gentle satin-covered pillow and like feed us peeled grapes and let us not have to deal with reality for a while. But, you know, we have a chapter in our book called Collateral Damage. But wait, there's more? That's the first chapter in the book. And it's about all the insults to injury that come along with the loss experience. And one of them is the stark reality that it kind of is on us. It is on us in this world to slowly figure out what our needs are, whether they're on a minute-to-minute basis or on a greater level, and get to a point where we can state those needs, because both Gabby and I found that if you don't draw your lines, other people will be very happy to draw them for you.
Here's another, you know, we seem to have an especially hard time talking about children who've died. Mm-hmm. So here's one listener on that subject.
Hi, my name's Katrina. And when my first child was born, he had a pretty significant disability, and it was a difficult transition for our family, and one of the hardest things that people would say to me, and the most difficult and unhelpful, was...
So, by the way, here's someone talking not about a death, but a difficult birth, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. That God has a plan, and that God chose you because you're strong. The one that really hurt the most, I think, was... You remind me how blessed we are, meaning you're cursed and I'm blessed. So I tried really hard to take those comments with grace, because I know that people that care for our family and me, and they were trying to be helpful. So I tried not to get too mad, but every once in a while I just said, that's not helpful. Anyway, thank you.
So should you never pass on what you think the lesson is? Is that a fair advice? You know, God has a plan. You were chosen because you're so strong.
Yeah, I think you can't really assume how other people might be feeling about the situation that they find themselves in. And it's okay if it's hard. It's okay if they're struggling with it, as opposed to just accepting it and feeling like they were chosen for some reason. And also, I hate when people put this into like stark relief of like, I feel so blessed that I have a child who's healthy, as if like they are blessed and you are cursed. I feel so blessed that I have both of my parents, as if they are blessed and you don't have both your parents and are cursed.
Yes.
I think what they mean is that you've reminded me to be grateful every day.
Right.
That's important.
It's like, if you take one step back and really consider how that might affect somebody who has just had a difficult birth or lost a parent or lost a friend, and you're telling them how grateful you are to have a living parent above ground and have a friend above ground. Really? Do we really think that's the thoughtful thing to say in that moment?
I think also so many of these things that feel dismissive or thoughtless are just not said out of malice. They're said because it's really, really hard to know what to say. And I think it's okay to acknowledge, like, this is really awful. And I don't know what to say at this moment, but I want you to know that I'm here. Mm-hmm. Showing up, following through is so much more important than saying the exact right thing in any given moment, because there isn't always an exact right thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Modern Loss is the book. Candid Conversations About Grief, Beginner's Welcome. Yeah. It's okay to not know exactly what to do, but they can help. Gabby Berkner and Rebecca Sofer, and you can hear them tonight. You're at the Riveter on Capitol Hill.
That's right.
7 o'clock. You're in conversation with Chanel Reynolds of Get Your S Together, which is an organization that offers advanced care directives for your digital life.
So we try and keep it spicy.
Yes. Let's talk about the stuff that is uncomfortable, but we all know it's better to talk. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you. It's been great.
And thank you for tuning into The Record on KUOW, produced by Amina Alsadi, Allison Bruzek, Ajua Jimabrempong, Jason Pagano, social media producer Bree Ripley. Tomorrow, I'll speak with Spokane Congressmember Kathy McMorris Rogers and author Barbara Ehrenreich and actor Alan Cumming. That's all tomorrow, and it starts at noon. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for listening.